Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Shari Foos, a marriage and family therapist with practices in New York and Los Angeles. Foos, who served on the boards of the New Vision Foundation of LA, the New York Council for the Humanities, and BreastCancer.org, is currently completing a master's degree in narrative medicine at Columbia University. Shari Foos, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What is it that you think makes you different as a therapist from the collective people who are offering therapy today?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I guess I would say there are two pieces. One is that as a patient myself, I still always feel extremely close to those core issues that troubled me when I was a child. Mm. And I think the rebelliousness that I developed in adolescence is ever with me. So I really have a feeling for kids and out-of-the-box thinking. And that kind of a perspective, I think, informs the adult me from being too adult.
Interesting. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that, you know, sometimes people are doing treatment from a completely sort of corrective perspective, which I certainly do embrace. But it's another thing entirely to sit on the same side of the couch with them, so to speak.
Well, I'm fascinated by this sort of dichotomy between the adult and the child. You know, here I sit with you, I'm 71 years old, and yet a lot of people say, how come you kid around so much, or how come you're so young? Is that part of the therapeutic milieu that you're establishing?
Well, certainly when I'm working with adolescents, yes, because I think one of the reasons we have so many disconnects with kids is people somehow forget how they saw the world. And one of the things that's brilliant about kids is that they see all of the BS. What they don't have is a perspective of why you have to compromise, because things can't be perfect. And that's, I think, where they tend to get in trouble. But the beauty of their brilliance and aliveness and awareness is such a lesson for all of us and such a place from which we can join. You know, if you can really be honest with kids, whether it's as a therapist or a parent, you'll never have problems with them. They just want the truth.
Could you deal a little bit more with this concept of compromise?
Well, for instance, when you're a kid, let's look at what's happened economically. It would be very easy for a kid to say, well, all the bad guys should just, you know, give the money to the poor. Well, personally, I agree. I think that the rich should pay more taxes. But also as adults, we know that it's not just that simple, that, you know, there are all kinds of houses of cards that are built upon these social and political constructs. And even though we need to change many of them, we can't simply do it. And I think that's sort of the difference between the way a kid will view a situation and the way an adult will. That said, we need to listen to that urgency, because if you think back to the 60s when you and I were younger, we weren't wrong. We may have gone about things wrong, but we saw things as they were, and this was going to be our world. So same with kids in every generation. They really need to be heard and respected.
So you mentioned that you were a patient. I presume that you were helped and that sparked your interest in psychology. Could you tell us a little about what got you into therapy?
Well, I was an abused kid. I grew up in New Jersey in an upper-class community. And we were poor. We were, you know, there's like four poor Jews. We were among them. And my father was very violent and abusive. And although I started out being an incredibly curious, creative, energetic child, and I read constantly, over the years, I just got so beaten down, and I gave up on myself. And the thing that saved my life were music, on one hand, and psychology, on the other hand. And in the bigger picture, what I really see now is the humanities are so healing to people, both in terms of experiential connections with other human beings who share their lives and allow people to know you're not the only one who has those feelings, and the scholarly capacity to look at things intellectually and to have your intellect inform your emotions that have been so injured. So I had this tough childhood.
Sherry, did your father hit you?
He hit me. He basically just put me down constantly. Mm. I mean, the hitting wasn't, you know, it wasn't like beating me up and bruising me, thank God. But, you know, it really took its toll.
Can you give us an example of that abuse?
Well, his favorite thing to say to me was, you're a goddamn dummy and you'll never be nothing. So he was a vet. He had PTSD. He grew up poor. There are all kinds of reasons I certainly can understand now as an adult why he would have had to have projected those bad feelings about himself to get rid of them onto me. But in any event, there were things like that. There were things like stopping short in the middle of traffic because he felt that somebody was personally cutting him off. He was very paranoid. So he would have a boxing fight in the middle of the road.
No.
That was a tad frightening. And he had no friends. And just everything that he did taught me what not to do. And so I've brought up my daughter approximately 180 degrees differently.
You've been connected with something called the New Visions Foundation of LA. What's that?
New Visions is an incredible organization founded by Paul Cummins, who is very well known for having started Crossroads School in Los Angeles and New Road School. But there are many, many programs to help incarcerated youth, kids with disadvantages of all kinds in poorer communities, starting charter schools and starting after school programs, camp programs, things that really, really change lives. And my affiliation with him led to so many inspiring other projects that I got involved with.
So, you know, there are Freudians, there are Jungians. Who do you follow?
I'm glad you asked that. I think you can only be a Freudian if you're Freud. Why someone would be willing to trade their own mind, lock, stock, and barrel for someone else's, particularly when they've lived, over 100 years ago, seems silly. That said, there are schools of thought that, and I do understand why people would tend to identify with one or another. But I would say that I am eclectic, which is something in the field that's not particularly respected. I think in the world, people like us to be one thing or another so that we can put ourselves on a business card and wrap it up in a bow. But I'm influenced by a lot of different things. I'm influenced by the arts as much as I'm influenced by all of the different thinkers. I love the work of Donald Winnicott, who developed the idea of the good enough mother, which essentially is that in order for your children to thrive, you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be good enough. And that concept can be extrapolated to all things in life. And it's really good for perfectionists because, you know, we can't be perfect. And we are all always in the process of becoming. So I like his work so much as well.
What's narrative medicine?
Narrative medicine was developed by Rita Sharon at Columbia University, although the field has been developing for some time by quite a few other people. But the idea was to teach empathy to doctors and to help patients learn how to articulate their own story so that they could be heard and get their full needs met, not just be seen as the broken leg or the cancer or whatever it is that they get objectified into. And so the way that we teach empathy is by teaching close reading of literary and other kinds of texts and understanding them through discussions with others in a class situation. And in addition to that, doing storytelling, reflective writing, and some other really powerful tools, so that at the end of the day, when we pay close attention to the written word, we've discovered that we learn to pay closer attention to the spoken word, and that leads to empathy. So even if you're not the most empathic person, you can improve those skills. And in the case of the healthcare industry at the moment, as we all know, between getting those five-minute doctors that are ushering you out before you sit down, and on the doctor's end, you know, they're often not reimbursed very much. I have a friend who's a radiologist. She gets $3 to read an X-ray. So hopefully you're not the one that has the little cancer that's hard to read. But, you know, for all kinds of reasons, we get into bioethics. We get into learning what it is to express oneself and to really have the experience of being heard and being witnessed and witnessing. But you know when you're really aggravated about something and you sit down and you talk to someone about it, they may do nothing in terms of helping you solve your problem. They may not even understand the problem. But that experience of feeling heard is so healing. And in that, we realize we're human and that we're relating to a human. And it's an incredibly powerful process. So I've been extrapolating it and working with schools and kids and businesses and working to create team building and better communication in organizations. And it's really been effective, and I just love doing it.
For just so that we all understand how this works, could you give us, of course, without using any names, but a case study of something that worked in terms of what you have done with a particular individual?
You mean psychologically or within narrative medicine?
Either way.
Well, what immediately came to mind when you said that was I was working with a classroom of eighth graders this year.
Yep.
Through an amazing organization called the Lang Foundation. And they basically choose talented kids from Fort Washington to go through a scientific program every single week of their lives from seventh grade through high school. Kids who otherwise would not have this kind of opportunity, but really nobody would have this kind of opportunity. They're learning science and medicine with Columbia doctors, basically. So we were teaching them narrative medicine, and there was this one experience where a girl who has a physical disease was talking about feeling alienated. And, you know, there's not really a lot of opportunity within classes, particularly within public schools, for kids to really talk about their emotional lives, which is something I really noticed by the time I was in high school. I just felt like whatever you learn in middle school, you could learn in a minute. If only we could just sit there and know that everyone who seems so cool has that same experience that we do, and that we're all going through these trials and tribulations together. It's just a tremendous growth opportunity. So in working with these kids, when this girl was talking about how she felt alienated and there were certain things that she couldn't do, some of the other kids really started to open up. And one kid said, well, I moved this a couple of years ago from Africa, and I was the only kid in my school who didn't speak Spanish, and kids laughed at me. And one by one, because it became safe and rewarding, they would start to open up. And this was over and above the material we were teaching. This was just sort of one of those beautiful moments. And at one point I just said, is there anyone here who has never felt like no one understood them? And we started to go through a few very simple questions like that, and the group changed. And they reported back at the end of the semester when they did their evaluations how close they had gotten, and here they'd been together for over a year and had never had that kind of community prior. So I think that's one of the kinds of things, not just in narrative medicine, but in any kind of group psychology.
Now, how does that, Shari, how does that help in terms of the healing process?
Well, I think, you know, to the extent that whatever each of us go through, I went through abuse at home, whether it's something like that or a learning disability or a sibling issue or poverty or whatever it is, one of the things that exacerbates the suffering is feeling like we're alone with what we're going through. So when we start to understand that other people understand what we're saying, even if they don't know that particular experience, we feel human. We don't feel like such a freak. We feel whole. And indeed, when I was in high school, I went to group therapy and I saw a therapist individually, and it just changed my life. So that after I finished my performing life in Hollywood, I just knew one day that I was going to become a therapist. And my life just turned around for the best, and I now feel like I can really help people with their lives. So,
well, you've helped me with the segue, so let's go to your performing life. Tell us all about that.
Okay, well, I was in college, and I was doing summer stock.
Where were you going to college?
I was at that time at Stockton State in Pomona, New Jersey.
Gotcha.
And I think it's now called Richard Stockton State. My class was the charter class back in 1743. I was a theater major, and a film company from Hollywood had come to audition kids to play migrants. And now, none of us were or looked like migrants, but I kind of, in a Star is Born kind of moment, begged the director at 4 a.m. to let me be in it. So I was on the set, and I was in a bus moving 40 miles an hour. That was my part. And that was cut. But anyway, I just loved it, and I ate it up, and an AD, an assistant director, of course I didn't know what those initials meant, said to me, you know, if you're ever in California, give me a call. So I had to quit school. So I left school, and I went to California with $400 in a suitcase to serve me for the rest of my life. And I got there, and I had a friend who was there, so I borrowed a skirt, and I took a taxi to Paramount, and slid out of the car legs first, the way I had seen it done in stockings commercials, assuming like everyone in that situation must, which is, you know, here I am world. So I had lunch with this guy, and I figured, you know, he's not going to get me a starring role in a sitcom, but I'll probably have some sort of small recurring role. So we go out to lunch. He makes a couple of calls. Nothing. I couldn't believe it. There was nothing. So
what do you mean nothing? There were no jobs.
No jobs, no star jobs anyway. So I went back and I joined a theater company and
went back where? To New Jersey?
I went back to my friend's apartment.
Right.
I got my own apartment. I got a job. And I, for years, I would work for writers and directors, for lawyers, doing office work during the day. And then at night, I did comedy. I was in bands.
Wait a second. It's not so easy to do. First of all, I just want to point out to our audience, because they can see you, and I hope you don't take this the wrong way, you're a very pretty woman. So does that...
I'm insulted by that.
Does that help?
Well, you know something? In those days, I wasn't the ingenue type. I think I've fared better as I've gotten older. But especially in the 70s, you know, in order to work in the entertainment business, you really had to have a very all-American, skinny little perfect look. And I looked ethnic, and so that wasn't really in my favor. And I think that's one of the things that forced me to get strong, because I had to overcome that with my personality. So,
But you say, well, I did stand-up comedy, and I did this, and I did that. One doesn't just walk out the door of a rented apartment and say, I'm going to do that. What was that process like?
It was a lot of pushing and being on all the time. And it was working 24/7 with every single person I met. And in the long run, I really wasn't very good at it, because I never liked saying that I was great at something. you know, you should hire me because I'm fantastic, that it just really didn't feel comfortable. And for most of my career, I didn't even have an agent. So I was doing all that simultaneously, and it was ultimately sort of ineffectual to try and do all that.
But you didn't starve to death, that's for sure.
No, because I was always willing to work, you know. And so, I mean, I occasionally would get a movie or a project. I wrote radio, or I wrote late night TV shows. But in between stuff like that, where I was making what we call bupkis, I worked in offices. So I got by.
Okay, so you got by, but let's sort of take it from there, as long as we're doing this narrative, and then what happened?
I would say what happened was I started to volunteer for an organization called Free Arts for Abused Children, and I was working with abused girls who were in gangs, and they were of high school age, but they were out of school already. They had quit school or been thrown out. And I started to have this experience of meaningfulness, and I was teaching them improv, but I realized so quickly that this mattered. The show business stuff and my own egotistical fantasy to be a star and all that stuff was fine when I was very young, but it didn't mean enough in a world where life is short, and I really wanted to sort of turn around what I had suffered and make a positive imprint based on that stuff. So it really started to impact me. And shortly thereafter, I sort of had an aha moment when I was writing some late night television shows. And I realized, you know, we have this fast banter and it feels fun and clever, but it's time to go back to college and finish the BA I had left behind. And I did that, and I promptly did a master's in clinical psych and opened a practice, and that's how I got into psychology. It was really through performing, I suppose.
Well, Shari Fuss, I'm not going to let you leave the LA experience that quickly. I mean, when you say you were writing late-night television, like what?
Well, in the early 80s, that was the late 80s. It was before reality TV. There were some crazy late night shows on CBS that I was working on where I would warm up the audiences and write the shows and sit in for the host in rehearsals. One was called Night Games. Another was called The Love Psychic. You know, they were sort of early templates for exploitative TV. And funny, silly, meaningless, stupid.
You mean people come on and talk about dating or
exactly
that kind of thing, and somebody would have to tell them what to do. Did you know what to do?
Well, you know, no. I mean, we were writing questions that would incite, you know, sexy answers.
Sure.
so that was that part.
Do you remember a question?
Oh my God. I'll let you know if I can think of one.
Okay, so let's go on. You go back to New Jersey to finish up, or are you in L.A.?
No, I stayed in L.A. I went to Antioch University, and I finished the B.A., and it was shockingly healing. I never could have imagined that. And I am so in favor for all people, and I'm just urging the listeners, if you have not finished your degree for any reason, if you can go back and do that, or if you could even just take scholarly classes occasionally, to be able to get out of your own perspective and broaden it into a more of a world perspective is the most liberating thing. It that and human experiential connection, I think, really heal and shift the world. So I just had a great experience around that. And
Shari Fuss, I have to ask you this. I'm a great believer, as a lifelong college professor, of what we call non-traditional students, or people working for a while and then going to college, because you show me a student who has been out in the world and I'll show you somebody who knows an awful lot more than somebody who's coming in from high school. You know, we can't make that a complete set, but basically that's right. Do you think that helped you, and do you think that's something we ought to ask people to do?
Absolutely. I think that, well, first of all, it's not so easy to do it that way because,
no.
you know,
it, you might have a baby on your hip. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, but lifelong learning should be the way that we in this country think. The fact that we've slipped in the world educationally is appalling and unconscionable. And the fact that it costs $50,000 a year to go to college is wrong. Mm. I mean, that's one area that I would say with sort of adolescent thinking, that stops now. There is no reason why anybody should be in debt to go to school. There's no reason why people should shy away from becoming doctors because they can't make money doing it. And it's such a thankless job at this point. But I do think that there are certain kids who are just born students. And a lot of students that I see at Columbia right now who are really young are in it and on the path and just so focused at a young age. It's quite impressive.
So let's go back to the narrative. What about romance for you during all these years? What was happening?
Well, I actually, yes, I had romance. I was actually writing a book that was unfinished about it called The Jersey Girl's Guide to Dating and Failing in Hollywood.
And great.
Now that you heard the title, you don't have to read it. But I
that book needs to be finished, you know.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, one day.
So give us some of the basic principles from that, Sherry.
Well, some of the basic principles are all of the crazy ways of trying to make it in Hollywood, from, you know, sort of I Love Lucy kind of scheming to writing, you know, serious work or writing songs and performing. And it's an odyssey. I mean, I can't really think of a way to paraphrase at the moment, but it was just an odyssey.
What are some of the principles of the book?
Some of the principles of the book are to just go for it on your instinct. If you don't have the assets of connections,
sure,
and time and money, you just have to make it up, just the way I got myself into that that movie when I was an extra as a kid. Some of the crazy antics really just are ways of getting attention. Okay, here's something ridiculous. I would wear a hanger on my head. You know, as though I was asking a question. There you go.
You're straying from the romance question.
All right. Well, let me put the romance to an end. At a certain point in the 80s, I had known my husband, Richard Foose, for many years, and I had worked for Rhino Records doing lots of different projects. And we got together. Despite the fact that we had known each other for all these years, we had never really noticed each other.
How did you know him? We should report to everybody that Rhino Records is a major label and that your husband was a major person in that, right?
Yeah, well, he was the founder.
The founder, yes.
And he sold it about 10 years ago, and now they have a new company called Shout Factory. And Rhino was really known for reissuing music of the past with real integrity in terms of remastering and wonderful liner notes. And he discovered that all this music that he loved was absent and no one was reissuing it. So whereas now, obviously, you can get things quite easily, then it was literally impossible. So he started a business of that. And now this new company focuses more on video and TV and film and so forth.
So you said you knew him for a long time. How did you know him for a long time?
Well, I was on his label. I did a bunch of projects with him. And, you know, just from the whole scene around town, the underground scene, I would say, I knew him and I was in other bands and we knew people in common. But I think a certain
Wait. What did you do? What did you do in the bands? Did you play
in the bands that were on Rhino? Well,
no,
I was a singer-songwriter.
Singer-songwriter. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. Great.
So I was a singer-songwriter. I had my own bands. We recorded. We played out. I was in a band called Roy Rogers and the Whirling Butt Cherries that had a song called Who Put Timmy in the Trash? You can see that on YouTube. And, in fact, the Red Hot Chili Peppers played their very first gig opening for us at a place called the Kit Kat Club in Hollywood. And they were doing what we were doing, except we were co-ed. But they had a great manager in Anthony's dad, and obviously they have gone on for 30 years of brilliance, whereas we imploded. But
you had what we call a band fight.
We had a band fight, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was really fun. And so anyway, so Rhino reissued some of that stuff, and I wound up producing a video project for them with Dr. Demento, who you may know.
Oh, sure, Dr.
Radio
Demento.
Host.
Sure.
And so we just, I think as we got older, we started to realize that there were core values that we both shared that were bigger than whether or not I had a blonde streak in my hair at that time or he was running a business. And so we just really saw ourselves in each other.
Was he your first major love, or did you have others?
Well, I would like to say that he was, but no, he wasn't. I was in my 30s. Come on.
Yeah, no. Great. I'm just trying to get the narrative right. I want to know what's going on here. Yeah.
Right. Well, when I was 13, I had my first love. And actually, he had a family home in Lake Apakong where I went one summer and made French toast for the family in the morning. And one piece fell in between the stove and the wall, and I was too embarrassed to say anything, and I fear it's still there. That would have been my first love. And then when I was in high school, from 16 to 20, through college, I had my second love, and I had a couple of, you know, strong relationships after that. But nothing was really on the level of this person named Richard Foose, who really enhanced my life and has, honestly, the most beautiful values of anyone I've ever met. He's just, there's nothing wrong with him.
Well, a couple of things she said. I met him, and I think he's a really charming and very nice man. And,
yeah, he is.
He doesn't talk down to people. That's an extraordinary common thing to be able
he's
to do.
Incredibly kind. What he does do is snore. And he has a
sleep
whole
apnea.
Symphony.
So he has sleep apnea.
But it's not just snoring. There's a, you know, whistling and blowing and the legs shaking. I mean, there's a whole, it's
Have you sent him to a sleep clinic?
He's gone to a sleep clinic, yes. And, of course, when he came back, I had my video camera pointed at him and ready and did a short film on that. So we try and make fun out of our life debacles. He's not handy. And one time when my daughter was little, he was threading the car seat into the back seat. But instead of putting the car seat through the holes, he put his arm. And now the car seat was attached to his arm, and it was up in the air, and he didn't know what to do. He said, "Let's go to a hardware store and get a saw." So I said, "No, let's go to the fire department around the corner." So we went to the fire department. But not before I grab my camera, because, you know,
so really you've got him snoring
important.
And you've got him in a compromised position doing this car seat thing, right?
That's the way we like it, yes.
Now, Shari, how does all of this fit into the therapeutic model? In other words, when you do a narrative of this kind, it all sort of comes out. How does that help somebody, you know, be happier with themselves?
I think my kind of crazy part one of my life, in which humor was such a core part, threaded into everything, I think humor is so healing. Because imagine a person, yourself, in certain situations, or somebody who's really suffering. What happens to us is this becomes the whole world. I'm overwhelmed. I don't know where to begin. You know, I'm in chaos. If organic humor occurs, it just breaks. It's like, oh my God, yeah. There's another day. There's a bigger picture. And so all of these crazy, just disjointed things that I did when I was younger, which were really about my longing to be applauded, appreciated, heard, understood, were no longer necessary, because now I had started to develop something for myself, which I started to see in the volunteering. And I started to develop even more with Richard, and we got into a lot of philanthropy, and
we'll stop. So let's stop. Let's talk about that for a minute. What kind of philanthropy?
Well, the first thing I did through Antioch University was 14 years ago. I started a program at Antioch called the Bridge Program, and it's a year-long course for adults living in or below the poverty line, provided free. In which they learn humanities, they learn art history and literature and writing and philosophy and discover their intelligence. And it really changes their lives. So in 1 year, their lives really, really turn around. We just had one of our alum graduate Yale this past spring. It's quite a miracle. And it's just been really one of the greatest joys of my entire life. I was very inspired by something that Antioch's first president, Horace Mann, said, which was, be ashamed to die until you have won some small victory for humankind. And I just think, do one little thing, you know? I think most people do, but they may not credit themselves with it. Whatever you can do to provide for someone else another perspective on their suffering, to bring meaning to it so that it's not for naught, so that we can then change our lives or change the world a little bit as a result of that, makes the suffering have value.
How much internal discipline does one have to have? You know, I've had a lot to do with some of the Antioch people over the years. And I've often said that the kids who go to Harvard should go to Antioch and vice versa, because, you know, there's a certain amount of self-discipline that you need to have an open opportunity like Antioch does so well. And I'm wondering, as you go through all of this with patience and yourself, whether you think that the self-discipline is important.
I think that it's imperative. I think that that's one of the things that people suffer. They think that they don't have it, and that's the end of the story. Mm. But it's really something that has to be developed little by little with a lot of self-soothing. In other words, don't expect yourself to go from A to Z in a minute. I was working with my daughter. Her room was a mess the other day, and she was so upset. She didn't know where to begin. And in 20 minutes, it got better. So we can't give up just because of what's happened in the past. There's always a tomorrow. By the time I went to college for real, in my 30s,
was your father gone by that time?
Yes, thank God. He died when I was about 22.
And so you never felt the need to reconcile that relationship?
There was no way I could have reconciled it with him. I reconciled it in my heart many times in many ways, sure, by understanding that he was a victim too. Sure. Nobody wakes up to wreck somebody else's life. I mean, something happens to people in order for them to do bad things. And to me, it's like the more you're screwed, the more you're screwed. So if you get off to
a bad start. Sounds like Winnie the Pooh. Go ahead.
Well, the more you're pooed, right?
The more it snows, tiddlypuff. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I mean, if you're born into bad circumstances and you respond in kind, then you're going to be treated badly. And it just can be an endless cycle. So to harness yourself with some sort of discipline is very difficult because you haven't seen it modeled. So
exactly.
I was very surprised that, you know, I could be a good student at Antioch. And that was one of the reasons that I have come to see the power of scholarly learning, because that discipline that you must engage, even if you didn't know that you could, really changes your ideas about yourself and your potentiality. So that was wonderful for me. And, you know, now at Columbia, it's hard work, but I don't ever have to worry, you know, am I going to do this? Am I going to do it to the best of my ability? So it's kind of nice.
So what kind of life are you leading now?
Well, I have practices of marriage and family therapy in New York and Los Angeles.
How do you do that? You fly from one to the other in order to...
Well, I do a lot
patients.
Of Skyping, actually.
Really? Oh, interesting.
I do go back and forth, not as much as I'd like to. My daughter is in high school. She's a rising senior now. So this will be the last year where I'm really in New York almost full time. After that, I think we'll be more bi-coastal. But I do speaking. I speak to medical groups. I do a lot of hosting. I've been working with the Luncheon Society, doing interviews and hosting authors. And I do narrative medicine. I've started to work in businesses and schools, as I said. And so I'm sort of reconceiving narrative medicine almost as narrative management and narrative education, so that we can extrapolate these incredible, incredibly powerful tools to other situations to teach team building and communication.
Do you remember the Johnny Cash song, Boy Named Sue? It's actually Shel Silverstein, I believe, wrote it. In which the father names him Sue and said he was leaving and he was going to know for the rest of his life that he'd have to fight. And so he gave him the tool because people would be picking on him because of his name, Sue. Is that a narrative song?
Well, you know what? It could be my song, so call me Sue. I mean, I think I spent the first part of my life being Sue and, you know, the hanger on my head kind of thing, and just trying to compensate for being told that I was nothing. And I was all over the place. I had a great time. I developed tremendous skills that are useful to me now. But on another level, did I sort of blow 10 years that could have been more productive? I don't know that I could have done it differently, but yeah, I was Sue.
You heard about your father. What about your mother?
My mother was and is really kind, and that's why I'm not crazy. You know, she was very loving. She's doing really well. She's 90 years old, and she lives in Florida, and she's the queen of her independent living home.
Did she take your father on in any way because of the abuse?
You know, I wish I could say she did. I think it was a combination of her personality, and in those days in our sort of lower middle class ilk, divorce wasn't really so much an option on the table. And so I think she suffered quite a bit too.
You realize, of course, that a lot of people basically have the same sort of narrative. The father asked, how come you got 99? Where was the other point? I mean, we've heard this over and over again. So that allows you to work with them, I take it.
Absolutely. You know, all of us have suffered something, and whether or not that's immediately apparent to other people is another story. But when you're a therapist, I mean, look, I don't have one meaningless conversation all day long.
Sure.
All I do is connect with people on a soul level. They share their sacred experiences with me. I witness them, we sit together, we reframe their stories and understand them in another context. A good example is when I just said to you, you know, 10 years of my life, I wish I had done other things. Well, you know, that's absolutely true. But on the other hand, I realize, A, that time's gone. What am I going to do? But B, I can appreciate it in terms of the nurturance and the skills and the things that I couldn't have done any better until I could, you know? And one of the things that therapy does, I think, is it shows us the hope that instead of focusing on what you don't have and what you didn't do and how you blew it and how you were an alcoholic or whatever else was wrong, you're still alive. And there are infinite opportunities every day for us to do one little thing differently. Not the whole shebang, you know, just one little thing, because it takes a lot less time to heal than it did take to get undone, so to speak.
What about guilt that people suffer for their whole lives? They left a girlfriend and made a basket case out of her, or they did this or did that, and they carry it around for the rest of their lives. How can they get out from under that?
Well, I think some guilt is important. I mean, there are certain things that I don't think we should make okay. You know, there are certain things, whether or not we intended them, that I think it's appropriate to carry. You know, I think of, you know, Nazis. You know, I don't think that subsequent generations of Germans should be made to suffer for what their parents did, but the whole idea of never forgetting. If you do something heinous, you should live with that and have that be a driving force for correction. It doesn't mean that you should, you know, just lay down and destroy yourself, but make good on your junk, you know? I mean, turn the manure into flowers. And, you know, as far as beating yourself up all day long so that you can't move forward, well, then that's actually selfish. Do something for what you've done wrong. Make a correction for somebody else.
Shari Foos, how do you get your clients? How do they come to you?
I go out on the street with a hanger on my head.
Is it reputation, word of mouth, that kind of thing?
It is. I actually have never done any kind of advertising or promotion as far as that goes. I'll tell you what's really mind-blowing. After all those years in the entertainment business of pushing, and, you know, you can do a zillion things and lots of work and get no return. But in sort of everything else in the world, you put out some effort, something happens. And that was very shocking to me. So I basically, you know, went to school and did my work and connected with people and started doing therapy, and more clients came. So
obviously you're good at it, because if you weren't good at it, your reputation wouldn't be as good as it is. Tell me about one other thing that I want to talk to you about, and that is when I met you, it was in the context of a humanities program that you were very good to. What does the humanities mean in this mix?
The humanities are everything. I mean, it's within the humanities that we understand the trajectory of our own lives in the context of the world, where we really try and understand the world philosophically, historically, literately. And I would include in there the intimate psychological and emotional experiences of relationships. So my motto is bring your humanity to work. Bring your humanism into the places where they're typically not invited. And that's so much of the reason why the culture suffers. I mean, when people go to work, they're supposed to work. They're supposed to be productive. They're supposed to do all those things and leave aside their heart and their feelings. As opposed to in companies like Google, where I've never been, but from what I hear, your whole self is invited. And so you invest more and you extract more and you do great work because of it. So I would say that, you know, the humanities are a way for people to understand through the arts and through all of these other fields what it means to be human.
So, you know, when we talk about humanities, me as a college professor, you know, you think about English departments and history departments and people who turn over their notes and come in and talk to the students another time, some of whom are brilliant, some of whom are BSers. You know, I'm very concerned that when people leave colleges and leave higher education, they haven't really been equipped for the kind of humanity that you're talking about now, as opposed to the sort of, you know, rigors of to be an English major or a history major. I know it's an inarticulate question, but do you understand what I'm talking about?
I don't think it's at all inarticulate. I think you're right. I do think that this generation has been bred more to have a social conscience and volunteerism, which I think is wonderful. But, you know, it's not built into the fabric of our culture. I mean, there are things that we do, you know, in terms of with school kids and being nice and maybe feeding the homeless or doing little things. But as far as integrating that kind of zeitgeist in our everyday, I think as a culture we're sort of working toward it, but it's not there enough in education. And that is what your job is. I figure, you know, you're here, you're eating the food and you're drinking the water. You have been given certain skills and talents, regardless of whether or not you realize what they are or whether or not you value them. It's your job to discover what they are and to offer them to the world. It doesn't have to be on a giant scale.
I only have 5 minutes left, and I'm enjoying this so much, I just want to make sure I can ask you one more question about Penn State and Joe Paterno. What do you make of that as a therapist?
Well, I'll give you two thoughts. One is, I recently realized it's sort of shocking that this hideous story comes out, and it, of course, gains the ear of the entire country and perhaps beyond. But this has been going on forever with girls, and we don't really have a comparable example. That's just something I thought of recently. But in general, I think this is a good example of taking one's own suffering and making a positive impact for others. Because of these brave men who've come forward and shared their life losses and their agony and their mortification, they have brought light on a horrible situation that is now going to be more spotlighted and will give the confidence in the future to, for other people to speak out.
You say that it's an experience which has been suffered by many girls. Is that something you see in your practice, that people have been literally, physically taken advantage of because they're a girl?
1 in 4 college freshmen, females, will be raped. Every woman has an experience, and I don't know exactly what the number is. Maybe it's 50% or higher, but every woman has had the experience of being anywhere from treated badly to sexually abused, just as a course of being a woman, and then blamed for it because your skirt's too short. It's really something, again, I do think that more light has been brought to this in the last several years, but it is just a fact of the world that this has been going on forever. And, you know, women are made slaves in other parts of the world, or made wives as teenagers under slavery. So it's nothing new, unfortunately.
Shari Fuse, I have really enjoyed this hour. I want to invite you back to come back and talk to us again. Our guest has been Shari Fuse, a marriage and family therapist with practices in New York and Los Angeles. Shari, thanks for all you're doing, and I very much hope that you will accept our invitation to come back again.
I'd love to. Thanks so much.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.